The Lifeboat Hour with Michael Rupert, Sundays at 9 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
From the nightclub at the end of the world, this is Michael C. Rupert, and welcome back to the Lifeboat Hour. It is Sunday, May 1st, 2011. May Day, May Day, May Day. Yeah, sure sounds that way. First, let me start by apologizing for not letting everybody know that we were going to be dark last week because of the holiday. We didn't find out a couple of wires crossed until the last minute. That was a normal holiday interruption, and what PRN does on those days is they pick one of our best shows and they run that during the holiday. We have that communication taken care of, and so everything is kind of back to normal if we understand what normal is. We had a great response from the show 2 weeks ago with Scott Allen McGuire, a.k.a. Hawkeye. Very dear friend of mine, but also one of the best organic farmer gardeners in the world. And we had a great show with lots of feedback from that. There is one message that came in from Andrew Millison. We were having a great conversation with Hawkeye McGuire about rainwater capture. And Andrew Millison writes, Hawkeye gave some misinformation regarding roofing materials and toxicity. Asphalt roofs are accessible for rainwater harvesting after they've aged for a couple of years with off-gassing and loose particles washing off. I've irrigated gardens for years off of them. There is even the belief that aged asphalt roofs are acceptable for potable water, especially in an emergency. Additionally, clay tiles were mentioned as a great material, and although the material is benign, the crevices between the tiles can collect fecal matter, debris, and other particles. Therefore, they are not an ideal choice of material for rainwater harvesting. I want to thank you for sending us that, and I checked with Hawkeye, and he said, you're absolutely right. Hawkeye's concern was getting a new asphalt roof now. You might not have 2 years before you needed to catch the rainwater to grow food. But Hawkeye's show was so powerful. We're going to make him a regular guest on the show, which is good because, as most of you know, I've been living here in Sebastopol, California now for a month exactly. And we've already got 7 or 8 food crops in, everything from strawberries to kale to onions to garlic to chard, cucumbers, and this is a really amazing process. And, of course, my thought was, well, gee, now all I have to do is keep the radiation off of it. But Sebastopol is a beautiful place. I'm happy to be here in Northern California, especially given the way things are unfolding, and they're getting really sideways. So our guest tonight, Nicole Foss, this is her second time on the show, and there's a handful of people in the world who I would kind of go to when I couldn't figure out what was going on, maybe we could figure something out together. And Nicole Foss is one of them. I'm going to bring her on in a second. I picked out one little headline here that, actually two, that I wanted to mention real briefly before we go into the show. Story broke in Commodity Online, April 23rd from Luxembourg. I'm going to quote this. The global energy sector will have to kick into high gear to meet soaring demand, the IEA, that's the International Energy Agency, said as it warned of the end of cheap energy. The International Energy Agency warned that it won't be easy to reverse the rise in energy prices because it's getting harder to access and exploit conventional resources. We know that. Dot, dot, dot. IE analysts said the world needs another 50 million barrels of oil from new fields by 2035 in order to meet expected demand. Now, here's the kicker on this. Crude oil production from existing fields, meanwhile, is expected to decline from the 68 million barrel per day mark in 2009 to just 16 million barrels per day by 2035. I mean, I did the math on that, and that is that's a horrendously steep decline rate, and it really clearly paints, illustrates the position that we have put ourselves in, as the Hirsch report would have told us, of waiting way until it was too late to address these issues. But that's just a huge And my God, how these cornucopians from the IEA to everybody else have suddenly turned on a dime about peak oil, and they're now telling the truth, and I don't know whether to laugh, cry, or pound on the table. The other story that I wanted to mention real briefly, setting the context for what's going on lately, I mean, aside from just screwy, is that a truckload of tomatoes, semi-truck and trailer, was hijacked on the East Coast because food prices have gotten so high that was $300,000 worth of tomatoes. And apparently some organized crime rings had been casing that for quite some time. But that is a harbinger for things we can't expect as things get worse, that food shipments themselves will be targets for piracy, which won't be solely a problem for the Horn of Africa. It's going to be something that we're all going to have to think about. So it's we all know it's getting screwy economically and so forth, but in my opinion, Fukushima remains absolutely the number one most important story in the world. And it's rare that you find somebody with the qualifications of a Nicole Foss, who was trained as a... Well, let me just read her bio. Nicole Foss writes under the name Stoneley over at the Automatic Earth. That's www.automaticearth.blogspot.com, which she co-edits with her writing partner. The site integrates finance, energy, environment, psychology, population, and real politics in order to explain why we find ourselves in this state of crisis. I'm sorry, that's just my commentary on this state. Nicole's background is as interesting, and it's as multifaceted as her site. She has a BS in biology. She was a research fellow at the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies, was editor of the Oil Drum in Canada, and over her extensive career has specialized in everything from pollution control to nuclear safety. And did I mention she also has a Master of Laws degree? I was going to call you Helen because we're going to talk about Helen. Nicole, welcome back to the Lifeboat Hour.
It's very nice to be here. Thank you for having me.
Thanks. I know you've been traveling a lot, and you've been out there beating the bushes all over the place, and we appreciate you taking the time to come back. I wanted to start tonight, Nicole, by reading a quote from another woman who I admire greatly, who was Dr. Helen Caldicott.
Mm-hmm.
And she released a YouTube video on April 18th, and I pulled some of these quotes, and I want to start with that, and then I'm going to turn it over to you, opening with Fukushima. Caldicott said, quote, "Japan is by orders of magnitude many times worse than Chernobyl." Continuing, "This is the greatest public health hazard the world has ever faced." And then she ended saying, "We are arrogant. We have a lot of hubris. I think the reptilian midbrain of some men's brains is pathological. We are now in a situation where we have harnessed the energy of the sun. It is totally out of control, and there's simply nothing we can do about it." Is that where we are, Nicole?
Well, I think I would qualify that somewhat. I mean, she talks about Fukushima being orders of magnitude worse than Chernobyl. I mean, she has a complete appreciation of how bad Chernobyl was. I understand that. I'm not quite as convinced as she is that Fukushima is drastically worse. She talks about there being 10 to 20 times the amount of spent fuel used fuel at Fukushima that there was at Chernobyl, and that there was a lot more spent fuel than fuel in the reactor cores. I think that's somewhat of an overestimate. There is a lot of spent fuel there. What the key value to me that there isn't at Fukushima that there was at Chernobyl is the kind of accident scenario that is absolutely almost designed to pump radiation into the upper atmosphere.
Mm-hmm.
So what you had at Chernobyl was an accident where the reactor was not shut down, that went prompt critical while it was at full power, and the lid blew off. There was no containment whatsoever. So there was no question of having to breach any containment. There simply wasn't any. Then the graphite moderator caught fire. This provided a thermal impetus to absolutely pump radioactive material into the atmosphere for days and days until they could cover it in sand and lead and boron. So I think the difference is really that at Chernobyl you had a mechanism that was almost ideally designed to spread radiation at significant concentrations over very wide areas.
Mm-hmm.
I would argue that at Fukushima, there's an awful lot more radioactive material, but you don't have the same mechanism for pumping it over long distances. Yes, you will get volatile isotopes like xenon-133 and things at detectable levels in a lot of places. And you do, in fact, have other much more significant elements like plutonium and americium at detectable levels even in the United States. Because something is detectable does not necessarily mean that it is going to cause health impacts, however. You can detect things at a much lower level than you would expect health impacts. However, that argument is more true for xenon than it is for things like americium and plutonium, where you might actually ingest them. And her argument about the difference between external dose and internal emitters is absolutely critical here. I mean, although I think there are certain aspects that were somewhat exaggerated in that particular interview that you refer to, she's absolutely bang on in looking at the difference between external irradiation, which assumes an average dose over the whole body, and internal radiation, where you have specific small quantities of something like plutonium that lodge in parts of the body and then provide very, very high doses to specific parts of the body.
She was clear on that. Let me jump in and say for the listeners tonight, if you'd like to call in and ask Nicole Foss a question, the number is 1-888-874-4888, or you could email me directly at lifeboathour@collapsenet.com. And we can get in with Nicole that way. And Nicole, be prepared. I can see already we're going to have a lot of questions alternating back and forth between economics and the nuclear emergency in Fukushima. So we can do that two-step pretty well. We have a caller on the line already. Nicole, would you want to take a question?
Sure.
Okay. We got Jack from Nevada. Are you there?
Yes.
Hi, Mike and Nicole, thank you both for your work. And Mike, welcome to Northern California.
Oh, man, it's so beautiful here, I can't tell you. I was just at a maypole today.
Mike and Nicole, I follow both of you. I want to thank both of you for what you're doing. And Mike, my quick question could be for both of you, but more specifically for Mike, if you don't mind. And it's quick. Fairly recently, you suggested that by the end of June or by July, corporate quarterly reports will be coming out that will probably influence the stock market to drop, among other results, by maybe a third, or we'll see. So I'm wondering if there's any kinds of stocks or investments that in anticipation of that probable development that one should be thinking about getting out of or into at this point.
Okay, well, clearly for me, you know, the obvious issue from a strict economic standpoint was what the quarterly earnings statements were going to look like globally with all of the supply chain disruptions.
Right.
For a full quarter of operations post-Fukushima. It's not post, actually. It's still in progress, but you know what I mean.
Yes, I do.
And of course, everything in all of these bailouts and all these trillions of dollars that have been printed is predicated upon growth to even service the debt, let alone pay back the principal.
Right.
And the derivatives bubble is enormously huge at this point. And of course, I said, given the supply chain disruptions, which we've documented on the World News Desk at CollapseNet, from South Africa to all of North America, to Germany, to England, the factory shutting down, it's clear that the markets are going to be very distressed. Within that, however, I would agree with Citigroup, which I don't agree with often, but they issued a strong sell for all auto stocks because of the components that are now missing from the automobile supply chain that only come from Japan for almost any automaker. There's a lot of follow-on with that. Texas Instruments has announced a sharp warning because it can't get components. Siemens can't. You know, this is a major disruption to the supply chain. So I would stay away, and I really haven't seen a way to identify the hardest hit industries. It appears to be very widespread globally, and I've kind of sensed that there's an effort in the mainstream to not go too deeply into that supply chain story. Nicole, you got any feeling on that?
Well, basically, I think that the knock-on effects of what's happening in Japan are going to be enormous, not just to do with Fukushima, but to do with all these supply chains and the just-in-time model that we use. An awful lot of high-tech components come from the Kanto region of Japan, which is between Tokyo and Fukushima. So the impacts are going to be enormous, whether you're looking at radiation or simply people not being able to function in the areas that deliver these critical components. So absolutely, I think that's going to cause knock-on effects. And I think that could cascade through the global economy.
Yeah, I'm really clear that that's going to happen. But then we have these other events, and I hope to get to that later with Nicole, because I really want to see if she can make some sense out of what's going on with the dollar right now. Or other kinds of investments that are likely to benefit from these developments?
I wouldn't recommend anything at this point.
Okay.
I mean, you mentioned market to me, and I'm running in the opposite direction.
Got it. Okay.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you both. Appreciate you.
Okay, Nicole, let's go back to the nuclear stuff again.
Mm-hmm.
We have also seen recent documented troubles at the Daini reactors, at the Onagawa reactors, and there's another set of reactors that are affected. Although what I've noticed over the last week or 10 days is like the amount of coverage coming out of Japan has been reduced to a trickle as the Japanese government steps on this. Do you have any information on the other reactors that are affected?
Not specific information on the other reactors, although I do understand that they have had cooling issues.
Yes.
So they haven't had a complete loss of station power in the way that that Fukushima 1 did, Fukushima Daiichi. They have had instability. I think chances are at the moment that they will manage to maintain control of those, but I think we have enough to worry about with just the six reactors at Fukushima 1,
yeah,
and just with the four that seem to be involved in this problem at the moment, because there's a wide range of issues with these plants, and there's not enough information coming out of it. In fact, just very recently, there was a very interesting piece that was translated from Japanese to English on the web,
uh-huh,
about an ardent supporter of Japanese nuclear power. I'm just looking for his name at the moment. Michio Ishikawa, a former head of the Japan Nuclear Technology Institute, who has come out publicly and said, basically, the government and TEPCO are telling you a pack of lies. All the fuel has melted down. And he's given a lot of very, very specific details. I wrote about that in the latest article. I mean, if it hasn't been published yet, but the latest article I wrote on Fukushima, which is coming out probably tomorrow, will address this and put everything in context. So you were talking about Helen Caldicott. Well, I'm basically, what I did with this latest article is to look at the latest situation with Fukushima, with the different reactors, then to look at the debate that George Monbiot and Helen Caldicott have been having,
uh-huh,
this thing becoming increasingly acrimonious,
uh-huh,
and then towards the end, review the evidence of what actually happened at Chernobyl, because the heart of the argument between Caldicott and Monbiot really is, what evidence is there for the impact that Chernobyl had, looking back from its 25th anniversary? And the official story is, to my mind, absolutely ridiculous, that about 43 people died at Chernobyl and a few thousand people got a completely curable form of thyroid cancer. And to me, it's an absolute insult to,
yeah,
the people of the Ukraine and Belarus. And Caldicott mentions a really interesting study that has been basically rubbished from the point of view of the Western scientific orthodoxy. But the reason that they do this is because they would say the only data that is admissible is data that came through the peer-reviewed process in Western journals. And that very conveniently disallows all the data from Eastern Europe. So the official, the people who should have been studying this issue simply did not study it, and the people in Eastern Europe who, with what few resources they had, were desperately trying to put together a picture of what was going on, found that all their data was inadmissible because they were challenging the existing received wisdom. They couldn't get funding for studies. They couldn't get anything published. Because they couldn't get anything published, they were told, but your data doesn't count. It's invalid. It's not scientific.
It's not published. Yeah.
And they did eventually get a really interesting study published in, I think, the Annals of New York Science. I can't remember exactly because I don't have it in front of me, but their estimation is that there's been hundreds of thousands of casualties from Chernobyl.
Yes.
Now, I don't know to what extent you can actually say all of these were attributed to radiation. There were many things going on in Eastern Europe at the time, economic collapse, incredibly poor nutrition, and they were struggling against so many different factors. But even if you think that a claim of a million casualties, which is more or less what they came out with, is exaggerated, and I'm not saying it is, but even if one thought it was, even if it was only half that much,
yeah,
even if it was only a third that much, this is a drastically different picture than the IAEA would have you believe. And I think the official story has no credibility whatsoever. I mean, I've made a point of following what has been going on in Eastern Europe since I wrote a book on nuclear safety and the impact of Chernobyl, nuclear safety in Eastern Europe specifically, 10 years after Chernobyl. And I've been following what has been going on there with the liquidators and the children of that era. And it's quite clear that the impacts have been staggeringly large. I mean, George Monbiot has completely bought the official line, saying that, well, because only 43 people died, I mean, more people die in Chinese coal mines every week than ever died from nuclear power. And this is just completely ridiculous to me.
We have another caller, Anthony from Long Island. Anthony, are you there?
Yes. Thank you for this opportunity to speak.
Go ahead, man.
On the subject, I wondered, when I was a young man, I did a book report in high school, and the research that I had done had stated that if a nuclear accident ever occurred, that the poisons will continue to expand into the environment, and they don't stop. I mean, they just keep accumulating because the planet is somewhat like a water balloon, and I just wondered. Chernobyl is to this day, from what I understand, still growing, and with this situation in Japan, on the water like that, it's all going to go right into the ocean, and it's just going to continue to envelop the planet. Is that so? And one other point I wanted to make was that last year, C-SPAN's student cam winners were these a group of children that had reported how safe nuclear energy was and how it was going to be this great thing. And I just wondered where they got their information from. Why was their information provided to them in the books that they read so different from the information that I had gotten? Has there been an infiltration?
Man.
Has there been an infiltration of the media by the industry?
No, the banks own the media, and the banks are all about infinite growth. The corporations own the media. They're all about infinite growth, and they have sown a tremendous amount of disinformation. Nicole, please help Anthony out and see what you can tell him.
There is a tremendous amount of propaganda. There's so much misinformation. And if people choose not to look at inconvenient truths, then they can genuinely say that they didn't know. But it doesn't mean that the information wasn't out there to be discovered had anyone actually been interested in doing so. And the people who wrote this recent report that Helen Caldicott was talking about, I regard them as absolutely credible. People like Alexei Yablokov, he was a member of the Russian Academy of Sciences. He was Gorbachev's chief science advisor. These are not people who have no background in science who would put together shoddy pieces of work. I mean, they're doing the best they can with the limited data they have, but the official institutions are absolutely determined to ignore the information and rubbish it and promote nuclear power as if there was nothing to worry about. We consistently see the kind of accidents that happen are things that nobody had anticipated. And the way nuclear safety works is you have a design basis accident, which is what the designers consider to be the worst-case scenario for that particular plant, and then you design safety systems that will deal with that accident. But there are many, many things that have happened at nuclear plants that were never anticipated. Things like station blackout. That was the major impact, the major factor at Chernobyl and at Fukushima. For different reasons this occurred, but nevertheless, loss of power to the station is what caused the inability to cool the fuel and caused both accidents at a very fundamental level. The design basis accident at Fukushima was a 7.9 earthquake. In fact, there was a 9.0 earthquake and a tsunami. They had all their backup generators facing the ocean, and they were simply swept away and completely destroyed. The battery backup.
We're coming up on a station break here in just
sure.
a minute. So, but Anthony had asked about something about nuclear disasters continuing to grow. Do you know anything? Is that true?
Well, basically, at this point, Chernobyl is not putting any more radiation into the air. There almost certainly is a plug of radiation in the groundwater that will be making its way towards Kiev, among other places, but that happens very slowly. Fukushima actually is still emitting very large amounts of radiation 6-7 weeks after the accident, which Chernobyl was not doing. What the Russians did is they threw enormous numbers of expendable lives at Chernobyl and basically prevented the continuing emission of radiation from that plant. They haven't done that in Fukushima for fairly obvious reasons. I mean, nobody wants to volunteer to be the next set of Chernobyl liquidators, but that means that the plant is still emitting enormous amounts of radiation. And in fact, if you look at the most recent emission from Arne Gundersen, video from Arne Gundersen at Fairwinds, he is postulating that there was actually a prompt critical nuclear explosion
yes.
in the spent fuel pool at Unit 3, which definitely implies very significant amounts of emissions.
Okay, we're at the bottom of the hour. It's time for a station break. We're going to take you out, come back with Nicole Foss, our guest tonight. The number is 1-888-874-4888, or you can email me direct at lifeboathour@collapsenet.com. We'll be back with Nicole Foss, a new white trash song, and we'll try to make some sense out of the dollar after this break. Thanks.
To a progressive moment on the Progressive Radio Network.
This is Bill Bowie.
And this is Kelsey Flynn.
Of Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability.
We bring you news and interviews
with the likes of Wangari Maathai, Bill McKibben, Hazel Henderson, Paul Hawken, Francis Moore LePay, and many others. Tune in to Sea Change Radio here on the Progressive Radio Network on Saturdays at 7 in the evening.
Hi, this is Karen Hartglass, host of It's All About Food on the Progressive Radio Network. Please join me every Wednesday at 3 p.m. when we talk about the power of the fork, how our food choices affect our health, the environment, and the treatment of animals. Learn how a plant-based diet of fruits, vegetables, whole grains, legumes, nuts, and seeds is not only delicious, but gentle on the planet.
Rachel Trachtenberg for Rachel Trachtenberg's Pure Imagination. This is a show for everyone from our perspective as teens. Current events, art as life, music, and politics. Rachel Trachtenberg's Pure Imagination.
With co-host Julia Cumming.
Wednesdays at 1 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Not bad.
Not too shabby.
Are you asking questions about the fate of our planet, your spiritual direction, and how to find meaning in a fast-paced society? Voices of Wisdom with John Jeanette is here to answer those questions and more. Tune in every Friday at 2 p.m. Eastern Standard Time to hear sacred activists and teachers exploring the meaning of contemporary culture. The show is produced by Wisdom University with regular commentary by Jim Garrison and Will Tagle. I'm your host, John Jeanette, and I look forward to your questions.
You're listening to the Progressive Radio Network, your number one source for progressive commentary.
Big talking tattoo game. We're back on the Lifeboat Hour with Nicole Foss. We're going to pick right up. We got a lot of questions stacking up. This is a question from Jim Newcomb. Hi, Mike. I love the show. Had some concerns about the radiation on the West Coast as I have friends and family there. Currently live in northeastern Wisconsin, but had planned to move to Portland. Should I be concerned about radiation levels, and should that be a significant factor in my decision to relocate? Also, should I be taking potassium iodide anytime soon? Nicole?
Basically, I wouldn't be terribly concerned if you live in the States. There will be detectable levels of radiation. There will almost certainly be a certain number of cancers that end up being caused by radiation, but they will be completely indistinguishable from the enormous amount of cancer that people suffer from in any case. Mm-hmm. About one in three people are going to get cancer at some point. A vanishingly small percentage of those will have anything to do with any aspect of the nuclear industry. We're surrounded by chemical pollution and all manner of things all the time. And there's a really interesting video, actually an interview between Arne Gundersen and Dr. Stephen Wing, an epidemiologist in radiation safety that came out at Fairwinds fairly recently. And basically Dr. Wing was saying that there's nothing realistic that you can do to limit your exposure if you live as far away from the plant as America. Basically, there will be a certain amount of impact, but there's nothing you can specifically avoid, nowhere you can specifically be or not be, that's going to make any practical difference at all from that point of view. Now, if you live in the vicinity of the plant, if you live in northern Japan, you have something enormous to be worried about. We had a question on our site a little while ago about someone from Okinawa, which is awful lot closer to Fukushima than Portland, saying, should we leave Okinawa? And the answer I had for that was basically no, because the distance that you are from the plant, your risk is not going to be elevated to a point where you would even notice the difference, especially in the case of Okinawa because of the way the prevailing winds go. The prevailing winds do carry fallout across the Pacific. There will be detectable levels of fallout in parts of the states. It will be marginally higher in the west than further east. But it will be very, very patchy. It's not simply a function of distance. If you look at the radiation plume at Chernobyl, for instance, there are some areas very close to the plant that are essentially clean, other areas much further away that had much higher levels. So it's very patchy. It depends where the rain happens to end up. And it also depends on the ability of that particular accident scenario to pump radiation at meaningful levels into the upper atmosphere where it's going to be carried long distances.
Yep.
I maintain that the major difference between Fukushima and Chernobyl is that the Fukushima accident really does not provide that kind of mechanism, with the exception of the explosion at Unit 3 that did send material higher into the atmosphere. But that was a one-off. That was not like a moderator fire that was actively pumping radiation into the upper atmosphere for a continuous period of time.
Let me add this to the question, is that we've been kind of trying to track the radiation at the collapse net. And all we've been able to do is track it anecdotally, where we see stories about radiation levels at certain places. We've seen them in Idaho. We've seen them in Michigan. Again, windborne, rainborne. And there was one time here, right after I moved in, where we have a nuke alert. It's a pretty cheap radiation detector. It started chirping for a day. And we dosed on potassium iodide that day, believing it to be a sporadic, intermittent product of the trade winds. And then I stopped after that. But what we found is that there are NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, and many universities have radiation detectors on site, and you can find them online. And it's best to find one close to where you live so that you can check it on a regular basis and determine if the winds happen to be carrying anything that might even be significant that day. But I agree with Nicole, it's not that much to worry about. We're coming up on the time to play a new white trash song, and this is a song that we're going to come back and talk about the dollar too. I've got a question from a Canadian for you when we come back. This is a song from our double CD double wide from New White Trash. This is a song sung by Miss Kristen Weigart. Her vocals are amazing, and it so applies to the world we live in today. Don't dig too deep. New White Trash. You can find us at newwhitetrash.com. I'm in that band. I co-wrote 13 and sing on 20 out of about 37. You can hear our music, which is becoming ever more timely by the minute. This is stuff we wrote about a year and a half, 2 years ago now, and it's becoming more important, more relevant all the time. We have to break up the tension a little bit. Now, I'm going to set up this next question, which is from a Ellen in Canada for Nicole, who is also a Canadian. But I want to set it up with this. Zero Hedge, Nicole, on April 24th, had a story from Xinhua. That's the official Chinese government news agency. It says, China's foreign exchange reserves increased by $197.4 billion in the first 3 months of this year to $3.04 trillion U.S. dollars by the end of March. Jia Bin, a member of the Monetary Policy Committee of the Central Bank, that's an official government figure, he's not the head of PBOC, said on Tuesday that $1 trillion would be sufficient. He added that China should invest its foreign exchange reserves more strategically, using them to acquire resources and technology needed for the real economy. That was a clear signal that China intends to dump the dollar. And we see the dollar weakening at an amazing pace right now. So that comes to the question from Ellen in Canada for Nicole. It says, "Hi, Nicole. I've read that you live in Canada, but you don't speak or write much about the Canadian economy. I'm a Canadian, and I would appreciate your thoughts on our economy and the value of the Canadian dollar compared to the U.S. dollar. I have spent some money in a U.S. fund account. I have some money in a U.S. fund account, and the Canadian dollar just keeps rising. Should I hang on and hope that the U.S. dollar gains at some time in the future?" Nicole.
Basically, I do think the U.S. dollar is approaching a bottom. If you look at the perception of the value of the U.S. dollar, people are saying the dollar is toilet paper, it can only ever go down. When received wisdom becomes that something can only ever go in one direction,
right,
take the other side of the bet. Because who is there left to take the trend any further in that direction? Because people move prices by their actions, by buying or selling something. And if everyone is more or less convinced that the dollar can only go down and they have already sold it to the extent that they can, then basically the next move is very likely to be up. I mean, I've been calling for a major spike in the U.S. dollar for quite a long time. And I do think that we're going to see that. What we've got now is a constellation of trends that all move with the ebb and flow of liquidity in the market. So there are a lot of trends that move either together or opposite each other. So right now you've got stocks are rising, commodity prices are rising, the dollar is falling. All of those things are happening at the same time. I expect all those trends to reverse at about the same time as well at some point in this year. So I think we're going to see the markets fall. I completely agree with what your assessment about the markets that you gave the previous caller, that I wouldn't touch any of it with a barge pole.
No.
There's nothing I would buy at this point because I think the upside's incredibly limited. And the risk is getting bigger by the day. So I wouldn't touch the markets. But I think when the markets fall, we're also going to start to see commodities turn the corner, by which I mean gold and silver and oil and agricultural commodities, on a reversal of speculation. And at that same time, I would expect to see the dollar start to rise. People are going to start wanting cash because cash is what's going to be incredibly scarce in the future. And when they're looking at wanting cash, what you tend to get is a knee-jerk flight to safety into the reserve currency. Now, if anyone actually took a rational look at the finance of the United States, this is not something they would do. But markets are not rational. You get a knee-jerk flight to safety, which is not a rational thing at all. It's an emotional retreat from where risk is perceived to be to where risk is perceived to be less. Right now, risk is perceived to be much higher in Europe on sovereign debt default than it is in the States. So I think we're going to see a knee-jerk flight to safety and capital flight from Europe to the U.S.
That doesn't make sense to me anyway. I mean, the euro was tanking as the EU has been falling apart for the last 6 months, and now we have new bailout requests from Greece and Portugal and the Icelanders have and I saw people running for safety to the euro, and I thought, oh man, that's the height of stupidity.
Oh, well, it is, but that is not likely to continue for very long.
No,
I think as soon as we see this constellation of trend reversals, the euro is going to fall very sharply on sovereign debt default risk. The other factor that I think is going to prop up the U.S. dollar is the deflation of dollar-denominated debt. So as you start to see the collapse of dollar-denominated debt, because a massive wave of default, I think, is coming, you're going to start to see people trying to pay down dollar-denominated debt, which creates a demand for dollars. So I think we're very likely to see a resurgence of the dollar. Now, this is going to be temporary. I'm not suggesting that the dollar is a safe haven for years to come or any such thing. But I am suggesting that once we turn the corner, the dollar will probably be the place to be for a year or maybe two. Beyond that, you really need to start thinking in terms of hard goods because the currency relationships are just going to go haywire, I think.
There may be some play in currencies and with precious metals, but I don't see oil coming down because the decline rates are so severe, and demand I don't see much affected. We're at 112 now with gasoline at over $4 in most of this country. It's 425 where I am, and that's taking an enormous bite out of everything. All the follow-on every day on the world's news desk, we have all of these atrocious stories that that are just talking about what the price of oil, gasoline, is doing right now. I'm not sure that's coming down. Do you think that's possible, Nicole?
Yes, I do. I think we're looking at the same kind of situation that we saw in 2008, where there was a very similar spike in the fear of scarcity. Now, I completely accept the peak oil argument. I completely agree with what you were saying about 2035. In fact, I think it's actually going to be worse than that, mm-hmm. because I think if you look at it in net energy terms, it will be significantly sharper a decline than they were discussing in gross energy terms. So in the longer term, absolutely we're going to see a very sharp depletion rates. We're going to see an enormous collapse in the amount of energy that is available. Mm-hmm. But that's tomorrow. I would say that's not today. I think what we're seeing today is a rise in the perception of scarcity more so than actual scarcity. That what you're getting is supply and demand are tighter than they were, but what that does is it launches a spree of momentum chasing, a speculative bubble, where because prices start to rise a little bit on this perception of scarcity where supply and demand are tight, you get people throwing money at the sector. It drives prices up. They're bidding prices up continuously, getting ahead of where supply and demand would actually dictate prices should be, because prices are not determined by supply and demand. They're determined by perception of scarcity versus glut. I think just like in 2008, prices are getting ahead of themselves. Just like in 2008, we're likely to see a very sharp correction as the speculators dump the sector. They take their profits, they dump the sector. We could see a very sharp fall in prices. However, the point that I've made before is that just because prices are lower does not mean anything gets more affordable or cheaper, because I'm expecting people's purchasing power to fall much more quickly than the price of oil. So I do think that we're going to see prices fall, but I don't think we're going to see oil get any more affordable. And I think once you move past that very temporary fall in prices,
right.
which comes from the reversal of speculation followed by a fall in demand. So we go from reversal of speculation taking place over a matter of months to falling demand taking place over a few years. But I think we're then going to see prices take an absolute moonshot.
Was there a reversal of speculation in 08 before the crash? I don't recall that.
Basically, that's what caused prices to fall from $147 a barrel to
right.
about $33.50. That was the speculators dumping the sector. That was nothing to do with supply or demand of oil. It was simply a question of the speculators taking profits. Speculation went into reverse. They dumped the sector, and it crashed.
But the key
and
thing
I think
to
we're
remember,
going to see that
though,
again.
Is, I'm sorry. The key thing to remember, though, is that it was $147 a barrel oil that broke the back of the American consumer and burst the housing bubble.
I wouldn't put it that way. I think the amount that people were losing on housing and the contraction of credit was a vastly larger effect on the economy than anything that was going on with the price of oil. I mean, people were losing tens of thousands of dollars on the price of their homes. But more importantly than that, their credit was being squeezed enormously. They could no longer borrow
right.
on the back of rising home prices. So
right.
all of a sudden, the credit taps were turned off, and that just shut their spending down enormously. It wasn't money they had, but it was money they had access to because they could borrow it.
Mm-hmm.
And once you turned off that tap so you could no longer have HELOCs and the credit limits were being tightened, credit cards were being eliminated, lines of credit were being eliminated, that cut people's spending power enormously, far more than the effect of an extra dollar adds up together, of course. But I think I would say the effect on the economy really came from the tightening of credit.
Okay,
and that's
right.
what I would expect to happen again.
We're down to the last few minutes of the show. We got some questions packed up. Will Broom writes, Mike, people often think of discussing and preparing for collapse as being negative. To me, accepting reality is actually being positive. Remember Tony Robbins? His infomercials were a regular thing in the 80s and 90s. He's the guy who taught people how to tap their inner potential and make money. Well, guess what? He now has a video on YouTube called Tony Robbins Warns of Collapse. Oh, boy. That should tell people something, shouldn't it? P.S., I think you should try to get Dr. Robert Hirsch on as your guest some Sunday. Hirsch would be great. Keep up the great work. Jonathan, well, that's an emerging consciousness, Nicole, that you and I are kind of privileged to see, I think, which is that people are really beginning to embrace these events. And I'm starting to feel more positive about that. How about you?
Well, I do regard what I do and what you do as inherently positive. I mean, if we were being purely negative, we might just go hide under the bed or something.
Mm-hmm.
We wouldn't be doing what we're doing now. We do what we do because we feel we can have an impact for the better. We can help people to navigate the circumstances that are coming. There's nothing negative about acknowledging reality. What we're trying to do is teach people how to work with reality,
yeah,
and not lose their shirts and not end up completely destitute. And if I didn't think there was some point to this, that people could in fact make a difference in their lives, I would not be doing what I'm doing today, and I'm sure neither would you. I mean, we are what we're doing expresses optimism,
mm-hmm,
I think inherently.
Indeed.
And I do think to some extent people are embracing the idea of a more frugal future. To some extent, there is also the flip side of that, that be careful what you wish for because you might get it.
Yes.
But I think to some extent people are embracing this because they really don't understand what it means. I don't think a lot of people understand the extent to which material prosperity could completely collapse,
mm-hmm,
and what it actually means to have to try and be self-sufficient. Now, when they actually get there, they're probably going to find that there's an awful lot about rediscovering what it means to be human that will come about as a result of that, and that will be inherently positive. But at the same time, there are going to be some really, really uncomfortable moments that people are not currently anticipating.
That's the purpose of CollapseNet and what we do at CollapseNet. If you're new to this, if you've been at this for a while, CollapseNet is a network. It's intended to make available all of the wisdom that has been accumulated in some cases for decades in preparation for these events. You can find a lot of that in our free Lighthouse directory, moderated by Susie Gruber, and it's 1,360-plus hand-picked entries, resources, reading, checklists, supplies, connections, all there for you absolutely free. You don't have to come into this alone. We have a question going into our last 5 minutes from Christopher Dalton. Hello, Mike and Nicole. How long do you think the dollar index has to fall before the world stops trading in the U.S. dollar? I think you pretty much answered that, but you want to try it again, see if you got anything else?
I don't think the world is going to abandon U.S. dollars anytime soon. I mean, they talk about special drawing rights or moving to a Chinese currency as the reserve currency. I think at some point, yes, but not in the near future. I think the dollar is bottoming. I think the dollar is going to see a sharp resurgence. And although I do think we're going to see absolute chaos in the fiat currency markets within a few years, that's not today. And I think what we're going to see ultimately come out of that chaos, which I expect to be a few years down the road, is going to be some kind of major currency reform. But I think for the shorter term, U.S. dollars are actually not a bad place to be.
No. And for the time being, you know, I guess I'm watching this like a hawk because I'm just not sure I completely grok which way it's going to go yet. Certainly not confidently enough to bet all my eggs. I think the dollar's got a substantial distance to weaken yet before anything stabilizes out of there. But some event could happen in the world that suddenly makes Europe more risky than the U.S., in which case all the arbitrage that fled to Europe in the carry trade will come back to the dollar again. I mean, it's that screwy. We have a question from Richard Lewis of the Lifeway Hour. Not a question. He says, just quickly, your guess is good, but something she said about Fukushima pouring out of the reactors may be true, but it has dropped significantly. I'm not sure that it's dropped significantly. We had a story on the World News Desk yesterday. That was a scientific story and well sourced that said that the radiation levels were higher than ever. Do you know if they're dropping?
I guess April 27th, there was a story about the radiation levels being higher than ever.
Yeah.
And I think there's actually not necessarily all the information we need to see that's actually getting into the public domain. There are snippets. There are going to be conflicting stories because there are aspects of information, then misinformation and disinformation. Mm-hmm. But I think if we take it all as a whole, I would say that this isn't by no means over. At this point, after the accident, Chernobyl was over in terms of emitting radiation into the wider environment. Fukushima is by no means over. This is continuing. It's still getting into the water. It's getting into the ocean.
Yes.
We have containment breaches. We have spent fuel pools that have exploded, that are breached and are leaking. There is still enormous amounts of leakage of radiation into the area around that plant. And I would argue that although I would tell people in the U.S. not to lose any sleep over fallout from Fukushima, the story is totally different. If you live anywhere near that plant, that evacuation zone is nowhere near large enough.
Right.
And already at 40 kilometers from that plant, they have detected levels that were twice the compulsory relocation level around Chernobyl in 1986.
Okay, we're running out of time, and I totally agree with Nicole. There's nothing under control at Fukushima at all. The situation is far from resolved, and the most obvious thing that we all have to complain about is the dearth of accurate, trustworthy information on what's going on there. These are indeed precarious times. Nicole Foss, a.k.a. Stonelay of automaticearth.blogspot.org, has been our guest tonight. We always welcome her on the show. Her sanity and her wisdom, they help us braille our way through some very unsettling times. Nicole, thank you so much for coming back with us tonight.
You're very welcome. Thank you for having me.
Take care. All right, ladies and gentlemen, that concludes another episode of the Lifeboat Hour. We've got some good guests coming up. We'll make some announcements next week. It's a bright, sunny day today, and I just went out to experience a May Day celebration with a maypole, and I got food growing in the backyard, and I'm one of the luckiest men on the face of the earth because I also have the best dog that God ever made. So anyway, we'll be back with you next week on the Lifeboat Hour. Until then, do it one day at a time. Take care of each other and hang loose. Good night.